Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This week, we have a very special guest. Mark Crispin Miller is here to join us in the studio. And because we're talking to Mark while he's passing through town here in Urbana, this is not going to be a show where we're going to be able to accept telephone calls. We had to tape it shortly before we went on air. Mark Crispin Miller is probably well known to many of you. He is the author of several books that have been well-publicized and widely read, most recently the Bush Dyslexicon, published by Norton, which came out in last year, in 2001, and the paperback version just released to the Bush Dyslexicon. And it's been a big seller. It's gotten a lot of attention. And I think, given the events of the past 6 months, it's become an extraordinarily controversial topic to write on so critically. But before we talk about the Bush Dyslexicon, let me tell a little bit about Mark Crispin Miller. He is a professor of culture and communication at New York University. Mark has been there for 3 years, 4 years. Before that, he taught at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore in the media studies and writing programs for a couple decades.
Well, it wasn't that bad. It was about 15 years.
15 years, that bad. Okay, I think you're tipping people off then about Johns Hopkins. And you've been the TV critic for The New Republic. You've had a radio show on public radio in Baltimore for years in the 1980s and 90s. Isn't that right? And have just been basically a very widely written, widely read author and commentator on media. And in my view, one of the very leading and original critical media scholars in the United States. So it's a pleasure to have you on the air with us, Mark.
It's a pleasure to be on the air with you, Bob. Thanks for that introduction.
Well, hey, of course. Let's talk a little bit about Bush Dyslexicon, which is, I think, probably the most widely read book you've written. I mean, it came out with Norton. It came out. When did it come out exactly?
It came out June 11th, 2001.
So 3 months.
3 months before the day.
And so until from June 11th to September 10th, it was a booming seller. Is that
it
right?
It did very well. It was a bestseller. And it was, I suppose it's pertinent to note here that I got to go on all kinds of shows that I couldn't get on after September 11th, but I was on Michael Medved.
He's a conservative.
Yeah, he's a kind of gas bag cultural crusader, and I was on the O'Reilly Factor, and lived to tell about it. September 10th, I was on MSNBC in prime time talking about Bush and his communities of character. I don't know if you remember that.
Let's back up for a second. What's the argument of Bush Dyslexicon? What's the topic of the book? What's the argument? Why did you write it?
Well, okay, I can answer that very precisely. After the Supreme Court decision of December 12, 2000, I was really very downcast, shocked by what had happened, and was literally losing sleep over it. And one sleepless night, the title popped into my head, the Bush Dyslexicon. I got a kind of mordant laugh out of that. And I thought it might be fun, a kind of savage fun, to compile a collection of Bush's malapropisms. And I made some inquiries, and I was told at the time that Jacob Weisberg, who has been collecting those things for a long time, wasn't going to do a book.
This is for Salon?
Slate.
Slate.
Right.
Okay.
And he still collects them. I mean, there's a Bushism of the day, that kind of thing. So what I did was I got a commitment from Norton, and I started to sift through voluminous transcripts of Bush's utterances. And the more I read
– That must have been inspiring.
Well, it was an education because I realized that my original idea was a bad one. Just to make fun of Bush for his grammatical mistakes and so on and his ignorance was a mistake for several reasons. First of all, the whole premise that this would be a lot of fun was mistaken because it's not really a funny situation. It wasn't then and it certainly isn't now. Also, there's no way that such a book could really do anything but harden the defensiveness of Bush's supporters who have been persuaded to believe that he's a man of the people. The great achievement of the Bush propaganda team in 2000 was to spin this guy as a as just folks, as someone whose intellectual and linguistic shortcomings are evidence of his membership in the working class. It was a preposterous notion because he's from one of the richest families in the country. The Queen of England is a cousin of his. Nevertheless, they managed to parlay his sort of Texas, his West Texas affect and lack of education into a sign of his populism. So a snooty professorial collection of this guy's mistakes could do nothing but play into his team's hands.
And so the new Andy Jackson?
Precisely, the new Andy Jackson. Invoke Andrew Jackson in the introduction, right. Well, more important than all this, however, is the fact that what Bush's language has to tell us is far more revelatory than any mere collection of his bloopers would be.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he is not invariably inarticulate. I actually don't happen to think he's a moron. I mean, he has severe intellectual limitations. He's not scholarly or intellectual.
I mean, he has an acute memory, doesn't he? I mean,
he has inherited his father's prodigious memory for names and data. You know, his dad had a politician's knack for remembering faces and snippets of people's biography and so on. And W himself was one of these kids who had committed to memory whole archives of baseball data. You know, the only thing he really read as a kid would be baseball cards, but he...
So I have something in common.
He read more than that. Yeah. He retained all that. So he has a kind of flypaper memory, but also he has a kind of cunning that you really oughtn't to associate with imbecility. An instructive contrast would be Bush with Dan Quayle, who I think really is kind of a dumbbell. Bush is much smarter than Quayle, much craftier than Quayle. And I don't think he's a simple puppet either.
Friends of mine have covered Quayle. Reporters say that he's actually a genuinely nice guy, but he's not a malicious guy. He doesn't really have much of a killer instinct as a politician.
Right. And there's nobody much there.
Yeah.
I remember one of the anchors said after meeting Quayle for the first time in one of the network booths high above the convention floor, when I looked into his eyes, I could see the back of his head. I remember that as a very memorable line. Anyway, it's fun to trade these stories, but this is not Bush, right? That Bush isn't this way.
Yeah, so you weren't writing a joke book about this dumb stuff this guy says. I mean, that's not what this book is about.
Absolutely not, because I think it's very telling to see what Bush can say coherently, on what subjects he can speak articulately and on what subjects he can't. So there's a great deal of the book that compares how lucid he can be when he's speaking cruelly with how ludicrously unclear he becomes when he tries to sound a note of compassion or magnanimity mm-hmm. or any kind of idealism. Now, the book is, as you say, just out in paperback, and if I can just shamelessly promote it for a moment, it's got a lot of new material in it that reflects on his first year, 9/11 especially. I take issue pointedly with the idea that he changed in any way after 9/11.
This was a common presentation, even by media like the New York Times that were not supporters of his in the electoral campaign. Johnny Appel wrote a famous piece shortly after 9/11 talking about the epiphany and the transformation of George W. Bush into another Lincoln as a result of what happened on 9/11.
Yeah, gag me with a spoon. Another Lincoln, another Churchill, another Teddy Roosevelt, another Franklin Roosevelt, another JFK. Oh, what the hell? Another Alexander the Great, another Napoleon.
Yeah, really. Where do we stop?
Where do we stop? Another Jesus Christ, maybe? Another St. Paul?
Not another Muhammad, though.
I beg to differ.
Oh, really?
I got a section of the book that's called "It Takes One to Know One," because I think that Bush has the same tendency to reduce the universe to stark black and white that mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden has, and all this, by the way, let me hasten to add that I make these arguments through Bush's own language. You see that Bush. Let's return for one moment to your point about his transformation.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story, propaganda-wise. Indeed, the main spin that came from the media was that this guy has stepped up to the plate. Even though he acquitted himself in a way that would have gotten, say, a President Al Gore impeached, I'm talking about the first day of the crisis, mm-hmm. right? If Gore had done on the first day of the crisis what Bush did, Gore would have been a president for about, you know, another 3 months, I think.
Well, he would have said, well, why don't you explain that for listeners who might not understand why
okay.
that would be.
All right. We're going back to square one. Yeah. If President Gore had learned about the first plane hitting the first tower and then proceeded with his photo op in the classroom in Florida.
Reading
a book to first graders. And then had
while there are four or five airplanes unaccounted for aiming at targets.
All right, let's be yeah. fair. He didn't know that yet. 5 minutes later, Andy Card or whoever, you know, Erskine Bowles, whoever it would be, comes up to Gore and says, a second plane has hit the second tower. If Gore had zoned out on camera and then continued to read a children's book about a goat for another 5 or 6 minutes and then had retired with his advisors for another 25 minutes before a hastily assembled announcement, a kind of mini press conference, and then took off, lit out for the territories mm-hmm. and headed for points unknown. Nobody knew where he was. Members of his own party, you know, congressional types are standing outside the streets of Washington wondering where he is, mm-hmm. right? If all that had happened with a Democratic president, you'd never hear the end of it.
Oh, Bill O'Reilly's head would have exploded.
His head would have exploded right on camera. It would have been something to see. All of them would have – well, you know, and I say this. I'm not a Clinton supporter. I make this pretty clear in the book. But the double standard is really quite yeah. quite breathtaking. All right. So Bush acquits
himself.
We'll
get to Clinton later.
Yeah, okay. Bush performs in this really embarrassing way on the first day. And then suddenly puts on his war face. Really on September 13th, Bush pulls himself together. And it was the – you may have seen this. It was the televised telephone conversation he had with Governor Pataki and Mayor Giuliani that marked the turn in his performance and in his standing. Giuliani obviously had been asked to attest pointedly to the president's acuity and courage and presence of mind and rare skill, etc. Because Giuliani went on and on about this pointedly and mendaciously, saying you called us right away. You were concerned to know what was happening, and we could see if we were watching. He wasn't calling anybody right away. He was sitting there paralyzed. Well, Bush took that. Took the cue very well and went into this extraordinary performance after the phone conversation where he said, I'm a loving guy. This is a terrible moment. His lip was trembling, his eyes filled with tears and all this stuff. And from that moment on, Bush struck a very convincing posture of resolve and indeed kept telling us that he was resolved. He kept telling us that he was focused and determined and resolved. He kept telling us that he was focused and determined and resolved. He told us that he was focused and determined and resolved and looked focused and determined and resolved. He was a perfect propaganda spectacle because everything he said seemed to go with what he looked like, mm-hmm. you see. Mm-hmm. This was all that an anxious, traumatized nation really needed.
So he's just following the standard lines of central casting delivers that the head of state supposed to stay?
I wouldn't put it that way. Okay. I think he was speaking and acting from the heart. I think that this accorded with his ideal self-image as a tough, focused, determined, and resolved leader. Bush is extraordinarily –
That's why it was so convincing? I mean,
yes.
It really
yes.
did come from the heart.
Yes. And this is all an elaborate way of saying that his performance – after 9/11 really bore out the thesis of the Bush dyslexicon. When it comes to striking a tough and punitive posture, Bush can make it work. Bush can seem to be sincere. He likes the role of the warrior out for retribution. He enjoys mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. He cannot deal in any way with mourning, with grief. And I have a whole section in the dyslexicon, a whole catalog of his attempts to sound a mourning note, the kind of thing that Giuliani could do, surprisingly, because Giuliani is a very abrasive character. But Giuliani managed to convey not only toughness but tenderness,
yeah.
as did Tony Blair. And I think it's significant that there was actually arguably a more noticeable and fervent wave of American support, both for the New York mayor and for the British prime minister, than there really was for Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Bush could only talk about payback.
Mm-hmm.
From the start, he defined this conflict in warlike terms, promising vengeance. One might argue, and many have argued, that he had no choice because the country needed to feel that we were going to go out and kick ass. But I would say that there was a crucial misrepresentation in the way he talked about this and in the way he has continued to talk about this, which time will tell is probably disastrous. What Bush said, and this is from another section in the Dyslexicon, what he said over and over and over again after 9/11 was, they thought we were soft. They were wrong. Well, if you sample European opinion, if you read the works of, you know, any number of French or German or British journalists who know the subject of al-Qaeda, scholars who have studied jihad and so on,
mm-hmm.
French historian named Gilles Kepel, British reporters like John Fiske and Simon Jenkins.
Robert Fiske.
Sorry, Robert Fiske. Yeah, terrible mistake. Robert Fiske and Simon Jenkins. Chomsky mm-hmm. makes the same point. Bin Laden's aim was to incite a global conflagration, to inspire the Islamic masses to rise up against the West. In other words, what he wanted was a kind of global jihad.
He's getting it.
He's getting it.
Boy, so is he ever, as we speak today.
He's getting it. And the point is that he did not think we were soft. It was a provocation.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the act was motivated by the assumption that we would somehow start to cry and trudge home, you know, that we would give up. I don't know. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But the idea that we would, and I go into this in some detail in the book, is very mysterious. It's hard to figure out where that came from. But it is clear, at least from what people like Condi Rice said very shortly after the day, and Karl Rove, and I quote all of them in the book, it is clear that Bush thought this immediately, that Bush was immediately convinced that they were trying to weaken us and make us cry and go home, lock the doors. And it seems that everybody on the inside of the Bush-Cheney machine bought this. I actually don't believe, although I could be, you know, there could be evidence to the contrary, but at the moment I don't believe that this was a cynical pretense.
Yeah,
I think this was a heartfelt reading of the situation, and as I say, one with tragic consequences.
Hi, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today, you're listening, speak now, is Mark Crispin Miller, professor of culture and communication at New York University, and the author of the recent book, Bush Dyslexicon, which just came out in paperback, a critique of President George W. Bush. And Mark Miller has been in town just recently, so we taped this show while he was in town, so we're not accepting phone calls today. Now, in the book, the media play a large role. And this is a radio show about media matters. What is the role of media in your argument about George W. Bush?
Yeah, the Bush Dyslexicon is really as much about the media as it is about the president. And indeed, as I explain in the book, I'm using dyslexia as a metaphor. Bush himself may or may not be dyslexic.
There was a piece in, was it Vanity Fair,
right,
that argued that during the election campaign.
That's right, Gail Sheehy's piece. And I guess it's revelatory, since you ask about the media, that her piece made a splash only because of her contention that he is a dyslexic. What nobody talked about was the whole last third of the piece, and I discussed this in the book, in which she talked about her efforts to get the Bush campaign to say something about the dreadful environmental conditions in Odessa, which is the sister city of Midland, where, of course, Bush hails from. I mean, nightmarish things had happened there. because of corporate pollution.
While Bush was governor.
While Bush was governor. Really, the Huntsman Plastics Factory and Alcoa, of course, is a big polluter in Texas. And the kind of life that a lot of the blue-collar people in West Texas have to lead is therefore something right out of a, you know, Hieronymus Bosch painting. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you got the windows taped shut. Mm-hmm. You got little kids with respiratory illnesses as if they've been smoking 3 packs a day. It's horrible stuff. She tried to get the campaign to talk about it. And she had had an interview scheduled with Bush. And she suddenly got a note from Karen Hughes saying the governor will be unable to conduct this interview. That's how the piece ended. This is absolutely typical of how the Bush-Cheney-Rove machine deals with the press. They use a lot of tactics, some of them quite heavy-handed, to discourage any kind of question that they don't like. That didn't get much coverage. Now let me return for a moment to the question of dyslexia. I use dyslexia, as I say, as a metaphor. As the dyslexic person has a very hard time translating written symbols into sounds, so I'm arguing, does the brain of our polity, which is the media system in our case, seemingly find it impossible to decipher the writing on the wall? The evidence of Bush's unfitness, the evidence of Bush's amateurishness, the evidence of Bush's thin skin, all of this was abundantly obvious throughout the campaign of 2000. We could see it on television. Mm-hmm. Television is a merciless medium with certain people. You have a skilled performer like Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. You got somebody in those instances who thrives on television, who knows how to play to the camera. But you've got someone with lots of insecurities that they can barely mask, someone like Nixon, someone like Lyndon Johnson, someone like George Bush Sr., or someone like George Bush Jr. You've got someone who's as vulnerable before the television camera as a tumor is vulnerable to the X-ray machine. Mm-hmm. There was really no mistaking W's problems performing on television. But while the medium of television consistently exposed his shortcomings, and it exposed many of Gore's as well, mm-hmm. while the medium of television exposed Bush's shortcomings, TV as an industry, as a commercial corporate entity.
The commercial news media.
The commercial news media, TV I'm calling that, consistently overlooked it, was blind to it. Would talk about Bush as if he were a reasonable candidate. We'll talk about his performances in the debates as if they were adequate performances.
Yeah, let's talk about the debates, because I think that's the 2000 debates. There were three of them between Bush and Gore. And that is sort of now the main events of our electoral season. I mean, those are the three events everyone's supposed to pay attention to. And they're sort of like prize fights. And whoever wins those, if you win 2 out of 3, you should win the presidency, more or less.
Yeah, that's basically it.
And that, otherwise, it's just all a bunch of TV ads. What was your assessment of how the debates played out and how the press covered it? And then ultimately, why did the press cover it that way?
Well, the debates, it's a misnomer in the first place, because there were more points of agreement between Gore and Bush than there were disagreements.
Especially in the second debate.
The second debate was the most embarrassing.
Someone counted it. 47 times they said, "I agree with you."
Yeah, it was very moving.
In fact, in almost the entire debate, there was no disagreement at all on foreign policy.
That's right.
It spoke volumes about the degree of difference between the two candidates.
Or the absence of debate, right?
Or the absence of debate.
Now, this addresses the whole question of who runs the debates. And I think it's very important that we understand that the two major political parties hijacked the whole debate apparatus from the League of Women Voters, which had made an earnest effort to make the debates yeah. by including candidates who might be polling less than, you know, a certain percentage. The League of Women Voters would have included Pat Buchanan and would have included Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader, I believe, would have made Gore look almost as bad as Gore often made Bush look. Mm-hmm. But since the consensus that we saw, you know, was about 6 inches wide, the press had no opportunity, nor did they seem to have any inclination to get the two candidates to deal in any explicit or edifying way with the issues at hand. They didn't really come up. Mm-hmm. There was no, take for example, this is a good example, their discussion of prescription drugs, healthcare in general. It's really very – it's a bewildering thing to talk about. Okay, if we simply concentrate on what happened between Bush and Gore, it's bad enough. What happened between Bush and Gore on camera, Gore knew something about the patient's Bill of Rights, you know, which is a mild kind of quasi-corrective to some of these problems. Mm-hmm. And it had everything to do with the Dingell-Norwood bill. Gore knew what the Dingell-Norwood bill was. Bush didn't know what it was. Bush also misrepresented his own record as governor of Texas vis-a-vis the idea of a patient's Bill of Rights. Now, Gore tried to push Bush on this whole question, tried to get him to take a stand on the Dingell-Norwood bill. After the debate, Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson on ABC made merry at Gore's expense because Gore knew what the Dingell-Norwood bill was. They thought that this was a sign of his wonkishness, whereas they actually sort of appreciated Bush's ignorance, which struck them as refreshing because – and this is where the elitism plays into it – because it's their sense that his ignorance resonated with the audience.
They assume that this is what the audience wants.
Right. They assume the audience couldn't care less about these wonkish details. Therefore, Bush is the man we salute and we laugh at Gore.
Yeah.
All right. So if we simply focus in on those two, we see the deck was stacked against Gore always. And he was faulted for something that ought to have earned him praise.
That he knows something.
That he knows something. And that Bush, you know, alternatively was praised for something that should have been a disgrace. But let's broaden the picture. You know, nobody asked the question as to why prescription drug prices are so high. Well, that's a structural question.
Yeah.
They don't entertain structural questions. Nader would have asked that question. But that, I suggest, is probably the primary reason why Nader was excluded from the debates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you expect the two major political parties to protect their prerogative by keeping out challengers. That's human nature. But it is a sad day for democracy when the press itself is complicit in that kind of exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have historically been very hostile to third-party movements, especially when they come from the left. They're more tolerant of third-party challenges from the right.
And third-party challenges from billionaires who can buy lots of TV ads on their stations.
No problem there.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting there is a problem there?
No, not at all. Okay. I think, you know, Donald Trump is a credible candidate if he starts buying ads.
Yes, that's all it takes.
Yeah.
Lowell Bergman came to NYU and spoke to
Lowell Bergman, the CBS producer responsible for the story that became the movie The Insider.
That's right. And he noted that no billionaire ever gets bad press on any network newscast.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had trouble trying to think of an exception, and I can't.
That's a good point.
Yeah. If you have $1 billion, you're home free.
You're smart.
You're smart. You're good.
Yeah.
You're smart. You're just, you know, and so on.
So the media and George Bush. George Bush has a transparent or clear record on one hand that you can see with the naked eye of not being especially well qualified for this office and not being a very deep man. But at the same time, the press coverage doesn't point to this and alert people to it and say, what does this mean, and draw attention to it. But you're saying instead covered it up.
Well, there's two things. I'm saying there's really two things. I mean, on the personal performative level, the guy – well, he was a lousy performer. I mean, this is – how important is this? Maybe it isn't that important. Okay, let's be real purists about this and say the way he comports himself on camera, who cares? That doesn't matter. That's related to the claim that it doesn't matter if he uses a lot of cocaine or once did. It doesn't matter if he likes 14-year-old girls. It, you know, all this personal stuff is irrelevant, although in Clinton's case it's all – you know, it's all relevant to the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah.
The press downplayed all of those kinds of things in Bush's case. But there's far more than that, and there's far more in the case of any public figure that's far more important than all of that, you know, his personal foibles and his mm-hmm. deportment. I mean, Bush's own record as governor of Texas, his ties to the far right, mm-hmm. his shady business deals, the fact that he made out like a bandit as the chief executive of that state that made so much money, his baseball stadium deal. Some of the alternative press in Texas covered these things.
Yeah.
But none of the national media would cover any of them.
And you think had Clinton been a Democrat or Clinton in a similar situation, there would have been far more scrutiny and
Well, let's just look at the record. I mean, Clinton was scrutinized within an inch of his life, not for his support of NAFTA, which is a betrayal of his natural constituency, not for his prosecution of the so-called drug war, which actually landed more African Americans in prison than had been in jail under Reagan, but for Whitewater, which was a non-story, for Filegate, which was a non-story.
I mean, Whitewater is really low-level stuff, right? I mean, it's
there was no crime. It was not. They lost $40,000 on a real estate investment, and for that,
I mean, Enron wouldn't even bend over to pick that up.
Precisely, precisely. I mean, we're talking about the difference between fictitious petty crimes and actual major transgressions.
Now, Mark Crispin Miller, author of Bush Dyslexicon, our guest today on Media Matters here on WILL in Urbana. I'm having cognitive dissonance. You're telling me that there is – the news media coverage of George W. Bush has been much more generous and gentle to him than it would be to – had been to Bill Clinton when he was president or Al Gore when he was candidate. But I thought the media were liberal.
Yeah.
The media were supposed to be pro-Democrat. I thought – and this is – what's – there's a disconnect here.
Yeah, there is a radical
disconnect. Please enlighten us.
Enlighten you. Yeah, we do continue to hear that the media is a kind of liberal conspiracy, and I would be most surprised if even some of your own listeners didn't entertain this belief. There's a big bestseller on the lists now, Bias by Bernard Goldberg, which purports to argue that the media is dominated by liberals. I don't know how strongly I can put this. I make the case repeatedly in the Bush Dyslexicon. There is no liberal bias in the media. Now, if we define liberalism in very, very narrow terms and restrict it to prayer in schools, abortion,
flag burning,
and gun control,
sexual freedom. I mean,
right,
gay
sexual
rights.
Gay rights. You know, the so-called wage issues. If we restrict what we call liberalism or any political discussion to that narrow range of social and cultural issues, we might be able to make a case that –
drug testing maybe.
Maybe, yeah. We might be able to make a case that the media is more liberal than conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But if we factor in the areas of politics or political discourse that are really more significant than those so-called wage issues, which are fairly trivial by comparison, we factor in economic coverage. If we factor in foreign policy, the military budget.
Mm-hmm.
If we consider those areas as well, anyone who argues that the media has a liberal bias –
Corporate involvement in government,
yeah. The status of democracy.
Yeah.
Look, let's go through the list.
Mm-hmm.
If the media had a liberal bias, we would have seen some coverage of Ralph Nader's campaign. We saw almost none until the very end when he could function as a spoiler. But he, despite the fact that he pulled enormous crowds in the nation's leading cities, he got no coverage on TV at all. He was frozen out. And when the Democrats threatened him with arrest unless he left the premises of one of the debates, this wasn't covered. It wasn't mentioned. If the media had a liberal bias, the 8 years of the Clinton presidency wouldn't have been utterly dominated by coverage of non-stories, scandals that have been concocted by a small right-wing conspiracy, as David Brock has now made pretty clear. If the media had a liberal bias, Ronald Reagan's term in office would have been fraught with all kinds of negative coverage. It was a long love affair. If the media had a liberal bias, the coverage of the Gulf War would have been contentious.
But you know the issue. I haven't read the Bias book yet, but I've read a lot of the critique of the liberal media material. And one of the statistics they'll point to oftentimes is they'll say, "Well, there was a survey done of the National Political Reporters in 1992 in Washington D.C. Of several hundred of them, And something, I forget the exact figures, but roughly 85 or 90% voted for Clinton and only a few percent voted for Bush. And to Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh or G. Gordon Liddy or Tom DeLay, case closed. 90% of the reporters are voting for Clinton. When you're telling me the coverage, you know, the coverage obviously is going to be pro-Clinton. It's a slam dunk. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's an important point to bring up, and indeed Bernard Goldberg makes much of this fact that a majority of Washington reporters in 1992 voted for Clinton. There's several things to say. First of all, Clinton is not a liberal. Okay, that's one point that I think it's important to make. You know, Clinton was pro-free trade, pro-death penalty. Made no modifications in the military budget. We could go on and on and on. It's only because our own political culture is so impoverished and ludicrous that anyone could claim that Clinton represents any kind of liberal activism, because he doesn't. Second of all, a nervous liberal is a far more useful ally to the right than a staunch card-carrying conservative. If you watch the coverage of just about any major issue of the last 15 years, you'll be struck by the fact that the so-called liberal reporters are always bending over backwards to accommodate the right, because they're afraid of being slandered as liberal sympathizers.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I'll give you an example of that. Rick Kaplan, former president of CNN during the late 1990s and a longtime producer of the Nightline show, Ted Koppel, is one of our alums here at the University of Illinois. He graciously comes here once a year and teaches for a week. He now teaches at Harvard at the Kennedy School. And he was talking about that exact issue. He said, and he's on the record, I mean, I was a Clinton supporter. I'm a friend of the Clintons. I have a lot of respect for Bill and Hillary Clinton. I consider them friends, and I did while I was the head of CNN. And because of that, I covered them much more I was much harder in my coverage of them than I would have been otherwise. He said, when that sex scandal first emerged, had it been a Republican, I probably wouldn't have covered it, because I would say it's not a story. But I knew once the Lewinsky story developed, I had to cover it really hard, because people would accuse me of being pro-Clinton if I didn't give it hard coverage, even though I didn't think it was a legitimate story. And he said, I'm willing to bet if you look at my coverage at CNN during 1998, it was harder than any other medium on television, because I was so concerned to bend that stick so no one would think I was being soft on my friend.
There you go. I'm QED, and God bless him for his candor.
Yeah. He was
well, that's absolutely true. Therefore suits the purposes of people like Richard Mellon Scaife, the big donor to the right wing, to have a lot of edgy, conscience-stricken liberals in decision-making positions in the media, because they're the ones who feel obliged to bend over backwards, whereas the people on the right, people like Rush Limbaugh and like Bill O'Reilly, don't feel any compunction to bend over for people on the so-called left. You know, they're really very, very few people on the left. I mean, people who have a class consciousness and believe in economic equality and justice, there are very few people like that in the mainstream media, you know.
In fact, I think you can even go lower than that. Are there any?
There may not be any, actually. I mean, like Katrina Vandenhoevel was a regular commentator on Hardball until 9/11. And then she wasn't asked back anymore.
You know, it seems like, for example, Christopher Hitchens is a well-known left writer. Hardly got any mainstream political coverage, but as soon as he started dropping sort of left politics and talking about the Clintons critically and praising the war, suddenly he's all over the place. He's become a prominent figure.
Absolutely. If he had been as hard on the war on terrorism as he was on Henry Kissinger, he wouldn't get much of a tumble. And his work on Kissinger didn't get any attention.
Yeah, none at all in the United
It was
States.
All marginal. And that's one of his best books.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, Christopher, for whatever reason, I think has gone off the deep end. But it's a very lucrative place to be swimming, you know, because he says what sells as far as the media people are concerned.
So we've got, going back to the Bush dyslexicon, we have a media that basically aren't challenging him. Now, how much of that is due to the fact, not to the media themselves, but rather the fact that the Democrats are just not hard asses? The Democrats aren't being, you know, if the media had a Democratic Party filled with firebrands who were passing resolutions calling for impeachment, who were demanding resignations for connections to Enron, who were exposing all this chicanery, similar to the Tom DeLays and the Lotz and the Republican side, do you think the media would then be emboldened, or do you think the media exogenously or independently is just doing this on its own? How much is just the fact that we have such a weak opposition?
I think a lot of it has to do with that. I think that's a very good point. I think that if there were an opposition party of firebrands, if there were an opposition party, you know, then the press would probably be more active. They would feel emboldened to be more active. They'd still be bending over backwards, I think, to cut the right a lot of slack, and that has to do with the fact that ultimately they are fed and clothed by conservative interests. I mean, the people at the very top, the managers and the major shareholders of these media corporations are in the corner of Bush-Cheney. You know, the fact that the election in 2000 was called the way it was prematurely for Bush had everything to do with the complicity of Fox and NBC. And we know now that the guy at Fox, John Ellis, who was manning the decision desk that night and who was Bush's cousin, was on the phone repeatedly with Rupert Murdoch himself. This we get from John Nichols' excellent book, Jews for Buchanan. And similarly, we know that Jack Welch, Neutron Jack Welch, mm-hmm. head of General Electric, which owns NBC, was actually in the newsroom of the network, say, you know, pushing them to follow Fox's lead, call the
radio. Yeah, they actually have that on tape.
They have it on tape, you know.
Yeah.
But of course it would aid the terrorists to pursue that investigation,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, we can't have our maximum leader undermined.
No, we obviously can't. The fact is though that if we had a vigorous opposition, it would make a tremendous difference. The crucial question is why don't we?
Yeah. Okay. Good. Answer that. Why don't we? Yeah. Now we can solve. Then we'll go after world hunger.
We don't really have a two-party system. You know, we have a one-party system.
Mm-hmm.
The people, with a very few exceptions, the Democrats in Congress, don't have the proverbial fire in the belly because they don't really stand for anything that they ardently believe in distinct opposition to what the right believes in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I think is really beyond argument. You've got people like Bernie Sanders and Paul Wellstone. You've got a few people. But for the most part, you have people like Daschle, who's also, you know, an Enron money recipient, whose wife was a big lobbyist for the airlines, et cetera, et cetera. They're part of the same – they feed from the same big teat, you know?
Trough,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Or teat. That's
teat,
nice too.
Trough. They feed from it.
Yeah.
And since they're there cheek by cheek, they can't really fight very convincingly.
Mm-hmm.
And the media is also part of the same system. This all comes down to the prosaic problem of how we do elections in this country,
mm-hmm.
that it's all based on TV and radio propaganda, which is inordinately expensive and which requires these politicians to go whoring around after, you know, dollars all the time. If we don't solve that problem, the democracy is really finished.
Oh, we're talking with Mr. Happiness himself, Mark Crispin Miller, author of Bush
Dyslexicon. This is only one side of me.
Yeah, and professor at NYU who's visiting us here in Urbana. And we taped this show a couple of days before we went on air, so we aren't accepting phone calls today. If you've been trying to get through, we apologize. And we're talking about the state of American democracy, his book, Bush Dyslexicon, and the state of the media. One of the hats you wear is that a few years ago, you started a group called the Project on Media Ownership, PROMO. What was – it still exists, and it's going strong. It's going. but what was the idea behind PROMO, and what's the purpose of PROMO?
Well, in 1996, I finally persuaded a magazine to start publishing charts of ownership.
Are we allowed to name the magazine?
It was The Nation.
Okay.
But I had tried and failed to get a number of magazines with no disrespect to The Nation. I wanted one that simply wasn't preaching to the choir all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I approached a number of magazines and suggested that they run charts on a regular basis.
Larger circulation publications?
Larger circulation.
Which ones?
Atlantic,
Harper's.
Harper's. And I think Harper's would have done it but for a kind of editorial screw-up. It wasn't mm-hmm. because of any kind of ideological disinclination.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
But for whatever reason, I failed. Finally, though, the Nation agreed to do it. So since then, the project published a number of, I think, about five charts demonstrating the corporate ownership of different culture industries. Because by the mid-90s, I was already struck by how book publishing, magazines, TV, radio, how they were all basically industries disappearing into the same corporate maw.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the American people ought to know this because I was struck in my own lecturing and talk radio appearances and so on that people on the one hand didn't know anything about it but on the other hand suspected something like this was happening mm-hmm. and wanted to know about it. So I set up
Perlmutter. Fewer and fewer corporate owners owning more and more.
Exactly. That.
And you, this group outlines that, chronicles it, details it, and gives empirical data.
We want to just simply, first of all, publicize the facts about who owns what and to explore the consequences of this kind of ever-intensifying consolidation.
We don't have a lot of time. We've got a few 10 minutes left or so. So, but what are some of the consequences? I mean, what are some of the concerns of concentrated media ownership, first of all? And secondly, how does this pertain to the Bush dissection? Does this have an effect on the sort of coverage that we're seeing of Bush?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the reasons why a lot of these very high-paid telejournalists felt so comfortable with Bush's banality and illiteracy was that he seemed to speak a language that belongs on TV. Even when he screwed up, it made for good TV because they could poke fun at his gaffe without talking about anything substantive. Now, that kind of brainless spectacle is all pervasive on a medium that's dominated by a cartel of huge debt-ridden commercial enterprises that are desperately competing with each other and always trying to jack up their stock price. It's all they care about is like the next day's ratings. That kind of short-sightedness leaves no room for journalism at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid to take the risk of having someone speak in a soundbite of longer than 10 seconds. They're afraid to, you know, discuss an issue in any controversial way or in any depth. To answer your question as succinctly as I can, there are really two major concerns as the media becomes less and less democratic, more and more corporate, more and more consolidated. On the one hand, there's the acute danger, which I think we're seeing realized day by day by day, the disappearance of anything like real news. It has disastrous consequences for journalism because for a whole host of reasons, there are strong disincentives for these parent companies to support or to fund any kind of real journalistic enterprise. They slash news budgets in an endless effort to jack up the stock price. Meanwhile, they gravitate towards lurid, titillating stories that they're sure will get a lot of people tuning in. So Monica Gate would be a perfect television story because it doesn't cost anything to produce, but it's salacious enough to keep people tuned in.
It doesn't take any great skill to report either. It
takes no skill to report. Skill is actually an impediment.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, and we could go on at some length about news, entertainment is also increasingly degraded by corporate concentration for similar reasons. Because of the irresistible anxiety for, you know, more ratings, the worry about pleasing the major shareholders, they will push every one of their divisions for ever higher profit margins. So you get even book publishing, which historically was a kind of cottage industry, not based on high profits. I think the highest profits that all the publishers of the early 20th century expected were like 3%. Now we've actually got the houses that are owned by Viacom and Rupert Murdoch and Disney and so on,
mm-hmm.
expecting profit rate, margins as high as 12 or 15%, which is absolutely unheard of in book publishing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
mm-hmm.
that kind of business. Well, that has an effect on the quality of product. It has an effect on editorial decisions. It has an effect on whether they'll even think of publishing books that aren't going to be blockbusters. The same logic obtains in movie making, both entertainment and documentary. It obtains in the music business. It obtains in the worlds of magazine and newspapers. It's aesthetically and culturally disastrous. just as the civil society is served very poorly by the journalistic consequences of this consolidation. So,
you know,
it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah, it isn't. We're going to have some happy talk here, Mark. No one's even listening to my show anymore. You know, one of your major works, in fact, I think it's your next major book, coming up, but you've been working on for 20 years, the study of propaganda. And I remember in talking to you on another occasion, you spoke about how commercial propaganda was the most effective form of propaganda ever devised. Which is sort of a striking statement because I don't think most people think of commercialism as propaganda.
Right.
When you think of propaganda, you think of Hitler and Stalin. You think of some brain-dead wacko at the airport with some crazy newspaper. But you don't think of sort of commercialism as propaganda. What do you mean by propaganda, and what do you mean – what was that point about?
Yeah, well, propaganda is always most effective when it's least explicit. So it makes sense that when I use a word like propaganda, people think of the most alien and coercive forms of propaganda. They'll think of Stalin. They'll think of Hitler. They'll think of something over there, not what we do. Well, this is a fairly recent development actually. Early in the history of both propaganda and advertising, early in the modern history, people in advertising and in propaganda made no bones about the fact that advertising was simply one genre of propaganda, propaganda being any systematic effort to move large numbers of people to some action.
In fact, as you probably know, when Hitler came to power, the U.S. ad industry and its trade publications was really quite admiring in the way they used propaganda, and said in more than one story that there was a lot of American advertisers could learn from Hitler and Goebbels about how to whip the masses up into support of one cause or another.
There's no question about it. If anyone reads the pertinent chapters in Mein Kampf, you'll see Hitler himself mentioning soap advertising as, you know, another version of the kind of thing he was doing to push the Nazi party. Lord Northcliffe, the great British press baron and the head of the Allied propaganda drive in World War I, said at one point, advertising is propaganda and propaganda is advertising.
So what's wrong with commercial propaganda? We've only got a minute, I'm afraid, left.
That's a tall order.
I know. It's a whole show. But just so we can wrap this up, to give some sense of the issues we're dealing with concentrated media ownership and sort of the decline of politics and political culture.
Okay.
A lot of it is commercial. We have this sort of commercial-based culture.
Propaganda tends to drive out non-propaganda. Propaganda wants to completely monopolize the environment. That's why propaganda drives use every medium available to fill in your space, to fill in your mind. Commercial propaganda is no exception. And in a system of commercial media such as we have, the commercial propaganda tends to drive out all non-propaganda, which also means that it tends to drive out all content that might in some way conflict, even if only tonally, with the commercial propaganda message. So what we tend to have is a kind of drumbeat that, while not warlike and coercive necessarily as it was in Nazi Germany, is relentlessly, constantly, inescapably trivial. It has to do only with sales. It has to do only with commodities. It has to do only with you as a consumer.
Commercial life, not public life.
Commercial life, not public life.
Well, that certainly is a good description of the era we're in today in the United States.
Present company excluded.
I'd like to thank Mark Crispin Miller for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. I will be back next week with another guest. Please join us then.